Beth Bennett, and this is How on Earth, the KGNU Science Show. Today is Tuesday, March 15th, 2022. Coming up, we hear from a research psychiatrist who headed the National Institutes of Mental Health about some exciting but little advertised changes in the mental health care system in the country. As director of the National Institute of Mental Health, Dr. Thomas Insel was giving a presentation when the father of a boy with schizophrenia yelled from the back of the room, "Our house is on fire and you're telling me about the chemistry of the paint. What are you doing to put out the fire?" Dr. Insel knew in his heart that the answer was not nearly enough. In his new book, Healing, Our Path from Mental Illness to Mental Health, Dr. Insel describes approaches that work both in the U.S. and globally. The path to healing, built upon what he calls the three P's, people, place, and purpose, is more straightforward than we might imagine. In his book, he offers a comprehensive plan for our failing system and for families trying to discern the way forward. Welcome to the show. I'm here with Dr. Thomas Insel this morning, who is a psychiatrist and neuroscientist. And to me, the coolest piece of his resume is that he worked on and developed the story of oxytocin, which is a neurohormone, neurotransmitter that facilitates attachment. But we're here today to talk about your new book, Healing, Our Path from Mental Illness to Mental Health. So we can focus on that today.
Well, good morning. Great to talk to you, Beth. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. So I think that we can start by talking maybe about some of the evidence for how healing can take place for different mental illnesses. And in your book, you have a lot of wonderful anecdotes about some of these strategies. Do you have a few favorites that you could tell us about some high points in an otherwise kind of sad story for our mental health care system?
Well, it is a sad story, but I think the hopeful piece of it is that most of the solutions for the problem are hiding in plain sight. We don't have a huge mystery around what to do for people with serious mental illness, schizophrenia, bipolar disorders, severe depression, sometimes severe eating disorders, all of these illnesses that we consider to be disabling and that are often deadly. We don't do well for people and families who have those problems, but we know how to do this. And much of what the book is about is pointing out this sort of tragic situation. Unlike COVID, where we didn't have treatments, we didn't have vaccines, we didn't know how to respond, this is a crisis for which we absolutely have the solutions at hand that we just aren't using them. And what are those? What are the things that really work? Well, there are treatments that are good, and those treatments, usually people think about medications, that's one class, but we have good psychological treatments and treatments that help with cognition. We have treatments that are neuromodulatory treatments that actually change directly the circuitry of the brain. And then, of course, the most important and the least used are those treatments that help people recover. In the book, I call them rehabilitative treatments, but there are a whole series of things that we can do in the community to help people regain a life, just the way after you break a leg, you know, we figure out not only how to put on a splint and how to relieve the immediate pain, but we help you through physical therapy to regain strength and be able to walk and ultimately to run again. We don't do that. We know how to do that for people with serious mental illness, but that that equivalent of physical therapy, that kind of rehabilitative step that may take months or sometimes more than a year, we really dropped the ball there. And so I want to, yeah, go
I
ahead.
thought that was one of the strong points in the book, that you make the analogy between mental health care and physical health care, and this idea that rehab takes a while, and we have to commit to that time and that connection with a real therapist for that length of time. So one example that I'm not in the mental health care field, so these were all new and interesting to me, but one example was what you call interpersonal therapy or IPT, which was developed in the 80s to treat depression. And it sounds like it's amazingly effective, but we just don't know that, the general public doesn't know that much about it. Could you talk a little bit about that one?
Well, that's one of several psychological treatments that we've had really for 3 or 4 decades. And that particular one was developed by a couple working out of Columbia University in New York. And it was simply identifying kind of in the moment what about your social interactions was setting you back. You know, what was it that you were self-blaming and going into them with these negative expectations, or was it something that you were eliciting? There's a whole series of things that look at patterns of interpersonal interactions that, in some ways, reinforce depression and undermine your mood. You know, Beth, I think the most significant one that I've really been intrigued by, in terms of the things that we are now beginning to do, but we haven't been doing, is trying to identify people with an illness like schizophrenia much earlier. So usually the illness starts between ages 15 and 25. And the point is that usually young kids are, you know, they're ill. Adolescents may take 2 or 3 years to get into treatment, which is a bad thing because the longer it takes them to get into treatment, the worse the outcome. What we know is that the current treatment is often in a crisis, giving somebody medication either in the emergency room or after a brief hospitalization, and then discharging them and hoping that they'll stay on the medicine, which they don't. There's a new approach called coordinated specialty care that was developed when I was at the National Institute of Mental Health, and that approach leads to a sort of comprehensive and more continuous treatment plan to try to ensure that anybody who has a first episode of psychosis will never have a second episode. And there are now 240 clinics across the country that are providing this specialized approach that goes for a year, sometimes 2 years, to ensure that somebody is getting kind of wraparound care. It's helping them to finish school, helping them with their social interactions, helping them with not just the symptoms of the illness, which are considerable, but with all the things they need to really become independent and, as we say, to recover. And that recovery piece is, I think, what we've been missing, and we need to begin to put in place if we want to see less disability, less mortality from these illnesses.
Right, and that's a really important thing with schizophrenia because worldwide the incidence is about 1% of the general population experiences some aspect of the disease. And like you say, continued care is really important. We can't have just a quick fix of, a short-term medication. So that's remarkable. I had no idea before reading your book that there were so many clinics across the country. I mean, that is definitely a positive piece of information.
A bunch of things are happening now that actually weren't even in place when I started the book. And last week, when President Biden, in his State of the Union message, said, "Let's take on mental health," which was sort of startling because we haven't heard that from the White House since 1979. It's just a long time to wait. But how exciting to hear a commitment. And the White House came out with a fact sheet that was just, I think, extraordinary. I mean, it was the boldest statement, literally the boldest statement about changing mental health outcomes in America since the Kennedy administration. It was the first time somebody said, "We've got to do this better, and we've got to really make a difference." And it laid out three big kind of proposals, one around just building capacity so that there's a workforce and there are the clinics and the opportunities for people to get better with this kind of continuous care. It talked about what they called connecting to care and changing everything from the telehealth rules to making sure that people actually could navigate and find the clinics that are available. And then in a brilliant message, I think the White House said, mental health is about more than mental health care. We have to think even more broadly about poverty and inequity, about the abysmal state of that many people grow up in, and that has got to be part of the way we think about this if we really want to change mental health and not just fix mental health care. I thought that was a really wise and perceptive declaration of wanting to make a change and doing that change in a very broad way.
Yeah, that's a really great story. I hadn't realized that the Biden administration was so committed to that. And what a nice flip-flop from the Reagan administration that kind of instigated the whole crisis that we're seeing in mental health care in this country. And that's such a good point that we can't just isolate one's mental health from one's social and physical environment, and that we have to take into account all the different factors, like you say, poverty, environmental pollution. And one way that you do that in the book is you talk about the three Ps. Can you describe what those are? And then you could tie them into this new plan.
Yeah, exactly. This came about when I was in a conversation with a psychiatrist who works on Skid Row in Los Angeles. And we were talking about this concept of recovery that I was really trying to understand. It's quite different than the medical model. And I thought when he was talking about recovery, he meant kind of a 12-step process. But he corrected me. He said, no, that's actually not the concept. Recovery for people with serious mental illness looks a little different. It's really the three P's. And I thought to myself, okay, so you've got Paxil and you've got Prozac, but what's the third P? And he could see I was kind of confused. And so he just shook his head and said, no, look, man, it's people, it's place, and it's purpose. Somebody who has an illness like this, particularly in the later stages of the illness, but all the way through, they need social support. They need people. They need, a safe place to recover. Being homeless or living in a homeless shelter is not where you need to be if you're going to recover. And then he said, third, most important and often completely neglected, they need a reason to recover. They need something to wake up for every day, a purpose, a mission. And as he, said, quoting Nietzsche, a person with a why can live with almost any how. And I think that's a profound insight that we've almost fully neglected in healthcare, particularly for people with these illnesses. We have a very hierarchical healthcare system built around payers and providers, but we don't empower patients to actually help each other or to find purpose, to find something that they are passionate about, that they want to get better to do, whether that's work or finishing school or having a family or helping other people with the same problem. All of that is entirely possible, but generally not engaged in the way we do healthcare today.
Yeah, and that's so true for all of us. I mean, I think of every one of us as on a spectrum from really healthy to really unhealthy. And so we can all learn from the application of these three Ps to our own lives.
Exactly. I mean, the point is really what we want for people with mental illness is no different than we want for everybody else. It's the chance to have a life and to have an ability and an opportunity to thrive. And of course, that's what we want for our children. That's what we want for each other. There was a moment in 1963 when President Kennedy, the last, really the previous president who was so engaged in this issue, he started the community mental health system, and in when he signed the Community Mental Health Act, the last thing he did before he was assassinated, the last act he signed, he said that It's time that people with mental illness are no longer alien to our affections, are separated from our communities. And I really took to that line. I think that this alien to our affections is a good way to put it, because today people with these illnesses are more likely to be incarcerated, they're more likely to be homeless, they're more likely to be unemployed. In fact, all those things are probably more true today than they would have been 20, 30, 40 years ago. So they are ever more alien to our affections. And that is why I wrote the book. We can't allow that injustice to continue because we know how to fix this and we're just not doing it.
Yeah, and there's so much in your book. So I'm really encouraging the listeners, if they have any interest in this topic at all, to read the book. And one thing that you presented that was really interesting to me, and I hadn't realized all the details, was the history. Like, you talked a lot in the book about President Kennedy's personal history and interest in the mental health situation of his sister. And that kind of launched that lifelong commitment that he had to improving mental health in this country. But then, of course, the Reagan administration came along, and you have an incredible graph in your book that really struck me. I'm a really visual person, so I keep seeing that graph in my head of the relationship between incarceration and institutionalization. And before the Reagan administration, there were a lot of people in mental health institutions, and the jail population was much lower. And then after the institutions were closed, those curves flip-flopped. And so now what we're seeing is so many people in jails and hardly anyone in mental health care institutions, because of course there aren't that many. So I'm wondering, what's your feeling about that? It sounds like you would really like to get health care back in the community and not revive the institutions.
Well, I think the first thing to figure out is how do you decriminalize this? Right? This should not be the domain of the criminal justice system. The cops didn't sign up to be social workers, and sheriffs and people who run the county jails don't really want to be running mental health hospitals. But that's what's happened. The jails and prisons have become our new mental health hospitals because there's no alternative. There's really no capacity elsewhere. And the book documents that, and at the same time that we closed all the state institutions for people with mental illness, we increased the capacity in our jails and prisons by almost tenfold. So it was just inevitable that we would go from one from healthcare, which wasn't great, by the way, to the criminal justice system, which is even worse. So, what's the fix? Well, we do need institutions. We're going to need some health institutions, some sorts of hospitals where people can go, and sometimes for extended periods of time, because as I said, it takes a long time for people to recover, and we need to make that commitment. But of course, you want most of the recovery to take place in communities, and we need to rebuild that network of community clinics, community supports. And that's everything from crisis residential centers where people can stay and actually live for weeks and months, to clubhouses where they can come for the day as they need to clinics where they can be seen in groups and receive pieces of the three P's as possible. So there's a lot to do. It's a lot to rebuild. The good news is it's actually happening. There's a whole new kind of community mental health movement that was instituted 2 or 3 years ago. So it's not recent, but again, the White House made a commitment last week to say, we're going to make that permanent. It's not just a pilot program. It's not just a grant program. But these are called the Certified Community Behavioral Health Centers, very much like the old community mental health centers, except built with all the lessons learned in the 1960s and 70s. So these are, I think, much more interesting and probably much more effective. And I think there are now 430 across the country that have been funded by the federal government, and the commitment now is to increase them substantially. So again, none of this was in place when I started the book, but it's pretty exciting to see all of this beginning to take place. And I'm pretty hopeful that this is a problem we can fix. There's so many other problems out there. I'm not sure we can repair in the next few years, but this is one that that I know we can do so much better, because honestly, we used to do much better than we're doing now. Some of what we need to do is just going back to what we used to do. It's not, it doesn't require a lot of innovation.
Yeah, that's fantastic news that there's over 400 of those centers already. And as I recall, one of the earliest examples was in Oakland. Is that right? Maybe you could talk about that.
Let's see. I'm not sure what the Oakland project would be, but I'll tell you there were, I mean, there's a an example I think I talk about in the book is one in Oklahoma, where in a rural part of Oklahoma, the northern counties, there's a certified community behavioral health center that developed out of an old county mental health center. And what they ended up doing was completely revising their crisis response system. They wanted to put in mobile crisis, but they ended up not being able to afford it. So they still used the police, but they gave the police force across the northern part of the state some apps that allowed them to stay connected and to immediately connect to a mental health professional for every crisis call. So it was, they had this kind of backup, and the crisis call could also bring in medical records as necessary. You know, one thing that's interesting, Beth, about that story, which rarely gets told, is that the app also included a button that allowed the police officer to access mental health care for themselves confidentially. And surprisingly, that was probably the most effective part of the intervention. Who knew? But that was actually a remarkable piece of this. And one of the things when they looked at sort of the satisfaction of using this technology was the most interesting thing is that the officers really appreciated having support for their own mental health, not only being able to get professional support for the person they were trying to serve in crisis. So there's a lot we can do. I think it's this isn't particularly complex technologically, but it does give us a lot more ability to get help to people when they need it, where they need it.
Yeah, and that's just a wonderful story of including the police officers because I think most of us don't think of care providers as being in need of help themselves. And of course, we all constantly need all the help we can get in life. And I want to be sensitive to your time. I know we have to let you go soon, but in closing, I just wanted to read a quote that you include in your book by the late Senator Hubert Humphrey that really struck me. And he said, "The moral test of government is how that government treats those who are in the dawn of life, the children, those who are in the twilight of life, the elderly, and those who are in the shadows of life, the sick, the needy, and the handicapped." And your book goes into so much detail about not only what we can do, but what we are doing already. And it's very uplifting for that reason. And so thank you for writing that.
Well, thank you. It's as I say, I'm actually quite hopeful that this profound injustice, which is how I look at our current mental health system, is fixable. And it's fixable in real time. And when I just look at how much has happened since the book was written a year ago, and actually how much has happened just in the last couple of weeks since the book was published, we're moving very quickly to address things that have just needed to be addressed for so long.
Yeah, it's great news. And I will link to the book on our show website. And thank you, Tom. This has been Dr. Thomas Insull. Thank you so much for talking to us today.
Well, thanks for having me, Beth.
That was author and psychiatrist Dr. Thomas Insull. We talked about his book, Healing, Our Path from Mental Illness to Mental Health, in which he describes many new community-based strategies for reorienting and repairing our broken mental health care system. This is a book from which everyone can take away significant lessons. I'll link to the book and Dr. Insull's website in the show notes. That's all for this edition of How on Earth. Our executive producer is Susan Moran, and I produce this week's show. Our theme music was written and produced by Josh Cutler. Additional music by George Gershwin. Visit our website at howonearthradio.org to find past episodes, extended interviews, and links mentioned in this program. You can subscribe to our podcast through iTunes and follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Questions or comments, call the KGNU comment line at 303-447-9911. For How on Earth, the KGNU Science Show, I'm Beth Bennett.